times, we see it in the struggle of the bourgeoisie against feudalism. Legislative reform and revolution are not different methods of historic development that can be picked out at the pleasure from the counter of history, just as one chooses hot or cold sausages. Legislative reform and revolution are different factors in the development of class society. They condition and complement each other and are at the same time reciprocally exclusive, as are the North and South Poles, the bourgeoisie and proletariat. Every legal constitution is the product of a revolution. In the history of classes, revolution is the act of political creation, while legislation is the political expression of the life of a society that has already come into being. Work for reform does not contain its own force independent from revolution. During every historic period, work for reforms is carried on only in the direction given to it by the impetus of the last revolution, and continues as long as the impulsion from the last revolution continues to make itself felt. Or, to put it more concretely, in each historic period, work for reforms is carried on only in the framework of the social form created by the last revolution. Here is the kernel of the problem. It is contrary to history to represent work for reforms as a long drawn out revolution and revolution as a condensed series of reforms. A social transformation and a legislative reform do not differ according to their duration, but according to their content. The secret of historic change through the utilisation of political power resides precisely in the transformation of simple, quantitative modification into a new quality. Or to speak more concretely, in the passage of a historic period from one given form of society to another. That is why people who pronounce themselves in favour of the method of legislative reform in place and in contradistinction to the conquest of political power and social revolution do not really choose a more tranquil, calmer and slower road to the same goal, but a different goal. Instead of taking a stand for the establishment of a new society, they take a stand for surface modifications of the old society. If we follow the political conceptions of revisionism, we arrive at the same conclusion that is reached when we follow the economic theories of revisionism. Our programme becomes not the realisation of socialism, but the reform of capitalism, not the suppression of the wage labour system, but the diminution of exploitation, that is, the suppression of the abuses of capitalism instead of the suppression of capitalism itself. Does the reciprocal rule of legislative reform and revolution apply only to the class struggle of the past? Is it possible that now, as a result of the development of the bourgeois juridical system, the function of moving society from one historic phase to another belongs to legislative reform, and that the conquest of state power by the proletariat has really become an empty phrase, as Bernstein puts it? The very opposite is true. What distinguishes bourgeois society from other class societies, from ancient society and from the social order of the Middle Ages? Precisely the fact that class domination does not rest on acquired rights but on real economic relations. The fact that wage labour is not a juridical relation but purely an economic relation. In our juridical system, there is not a single legal formula for the class domination of today. The few remaining traces of such formulae of class domination are, as that concerning servants, survivals of feudal society. How can wage slavery be suppressed the legislative way if wage slavery is not expressed in the laws? Bernstein, who would do away with capitalism by means of legislative reforms, finds himself in the same situation as Upensky's Russian policeman who said, "Quickly I seized the rascal by the collar, but what do I see? The confounded fellow has no collar." And that is precisely Bernstein's difficulty. All previous societies were based on an antagonism between an oppressing class and an oppressed class, Communist Manifesto. But in the preceding phases of modern society, this antagonism was expressed in distinctly determined juridical relations and could, especially because of that, accord, to a certain extent, a place to new relations within the framework of the old. In the midst of serfdom, the serf raised himself to the rank of a member of the town community. Communist Manifesto. How was that made possible? It was made possible by the progressive suppression of all feudal privileges in the environs of the city. The corvée, the right to special dress, the inheritance tax, the lord's claim to the best cattle, the personal levy, marriage under duress, the right to succession, etc., which altogether constituted serfdom. In the same way, the small bourgeoisie of the Middle Ages succeeded in raising itself, while it was still under the yoke of feudal absolutism, to the rank of the bourgeoisie, Communist Manifesto. By what means? By means of the formal partial suppression or complete loosening of the corporative bonds, by the progressive transformation of the fiscal administration and of the army. Consequently, when we consider the question from the abstract viewpoint, not from the historic viewpoint, we can imagine, in view of the former class relations, a legal passage, according to the reformist method, from feudal society to bourgeois society. But what do we see in reality? In reality, we see that legal reforms not only do not obviate the seizure of political power by the bourgeoisie, but have, on the contrary, prepared for it and led to it. A formal social-political transformation was indispensable for the abolition of slavery as well as for the complete suppression of feudalism. But the situation is entirely different now. No law obliges the proletariat to submit itself to the yoke of capitalism. Poverty, the lack of means of production, obliges the proletariat to submit itself to the yoke of capitalism. And no law in the world can give to the proletariat the means of production while it remains in the framework of bourgeois society. For not laws but economic development have torn the means of production from the producer's possession. And neither is the exploitation inside the system of wage labour based on laws. The level of wages is not fixed by legislation but by economic factors. The phenomenon of capitalist exploitation does not rest on a legal disposition but on the purely economic fact that labour power plays, in this exploitation, the role of a merchandise possessing, among other characteristics, the agreeable quality of producing value, more than the value it consumes in the form of the labourer's means of subsistence. In short, the fundamental relations of the domination of the capitalist class cannot be transformed by means of legislative reforms on the basis of capitalist society, because these relations have not been introduced by bourgeois laws, nor have they received the form of such laws. Apparently, Bernstein is not aware of this, for he speaks of socialist reforms. On the other hand, he seems to express implicit recognition of this when he writes, on page 10 of his book, "The economic motive acts freely today, while formerly it was masked by all kinds of relations of domination, by all sorts of ideology." It is one of the peculiarities of the capitalist order that within it all the elements of the future society first assume, in their development, a form not approaching socialism, but, on the contrary, a form moving more and more away from socialism. Production takes on a progressively increasing social character. But under what form is the social character of capitalist production expressed? It is expressed in the form of the large enterprise, in the form of the shareholding concern, the cartel, within which the capitalist antagonisms, capitalist exploitation, the oppression of labour power, are augmented to the extreme. In the army, capitalist development leads to the extension of obligatory military service, to the reduction of the time of service, and consequently to a material approach to a popular militia. But all of this takes place under the form of modern militarism, in which the domination of the people by the militarist state and the class character of the state manifest themselves most clearly. In the field of political relations, the development of democracy brings, in the same measure that it finds a favourable soil, the participation of all popular strata in political life, and consequently some sort of people's state. But this participation takes the form of bourgeois parliamentarism, in which class antagonisms and class domination are not done away with, but are, on the contrary, displayed in the open. Exactly because capitalist development moves through these contradictions, it is necessary to extract the kernel of socialist society from its capitalist shell. Exactly for this reason must the proletariat seize political power and suppress completely the capitalist system. Of course, Bernstein draws other conclusions. If the development of democracy leads to the aggravation and not to the lessening of capitalist antagonisms, the social democracy, he answers us, in order not to render its task more difficult, must by all means try to stop social reforms and the extension of democratic institutions. Page 71. Indeed, that would be the right thing to do if the social democracy found to its taste, in the petty bourgeois manner, the futile task of picking for itself all the good sides of history and rejecting the bad sides of history. However, in that case, it should at the same time try to stop capitalism in general, for there is not doubt that the latter is the rascal placing all these obstacles in the way of socialism. But capitalism furnishes, besides the obstacles, also the only possibilities of realizing the socialist program. The same can be said about democracy. If democracy has become superfluous or annoying to the bourgeoisie, it is on the contrary necessary and indispensable to the working class. It is necessary to the working class because it creates the political forms, autonomous administration, electoral rights, etc., which will serve the proletariat as fulcrums in its task of transforming bourgeois society. Democracy is indispensable to the working class because only through the exercise of its democratic rights in the struggle for democracy can the proletariat become aware of its class interests and its historic task. In a word, democracy is indispensable not because it renders superfluous the conquest of political power by the proletariat, but because it renders this conquest of power both necessary and possible. When Engels, in his preface to The Class Struggles in France, revised the tactics of the modern labour movement and urged the legal struggle as opposed to the barricades, he did not have in mind, this comes out of every line of the preface, the question of a definite conquest of political power, but the complementary daily struggle. He did not have in mind the attitude that the proletariat must take toward the capitalist state at the time of the seizure of power, but the attitude of the proletariat while in the bounds of the capitalist state. Engels was giving directions to the proletariat oppressed, and not to the proletariat victorious. On the other hand, Marx's well-known sentence on the agrarian question in England, Bernstein leans on it heavily, in which he says, "We shall probably succeed easier by buying the estates of the landlords," does not refer to the stand of the proletariat before but after its victory, for there evidently can be a question of buying the property of the old dominant class only when the workers are in power. The possibility envisaged by Marx is that of the peaceful exercise of the dictatorship of the proletariat, and not the replacement of the dictatorship with capitalist social reforms. There was no doubt for Marx and Engels about the necessity of having the proletariat conquer political power. It is left to Bernstein to consider the poultry yard of bourgeois parliamentarism as the organ by means of which we are to realise the most formidable social transformation of history, the passage from capitalist society to socialism. Bernstein introduces his theory by warning the proletariat against the danger of acquiring power too early. That is, according to Bernstein, the proletariat ought to leave the bourgeois society in its present condition and itself suffer a frightful defeat. If the proletariat came to power, it could draw from Bernstein's theory the following practical conclusion: to go to sleep. His theory condemns the proletariat at the most decisive moments of the struggle to inactivity, to a passive betrayal of its own cause. Our programme would be a miserable scrap of paper if it could not serve us in all eventualities at all moments of the struggle, and if it did not serve us by its application and not by its non-application. If our programme contains the formula of the historical development of society from capitalism to socialism, it must also formulate, in all its characteristic fundamentals, all the transitory phases of this development, and it should, consequently, be able to indicate to the proletariat what ought to be its corresponding action at every moment on the road towards socialism. There can be no time for the proletariat when it will be obliged to abandon its programme or be abandoned by it. Practically, this is manifested in the fact that there can be no time when the proletariat, placed in power by the force of events, is not in the condition or is not morally obliged to take certain measures for the realisation of its programme. That is, take transitory measures in the direction of socialism. Behind the belief that the socialist programme can collapse completely at any point of the dictatorship of the proletariat lurks the other belief that the socialist programme is generally and at all times unrealisable. And what if the transitory measures are premature? The question hides a great number of mistaken ideas concerning the real course of a social transformation. In the first place, the seizure of political power by the proletariat, that is to say, by a large popular class, is not produced artificially. It presupposes, with the exception of such cases as the Paris Commune, when the proletariat did not obtain power after a conscious struggle for its goal, but fell into its hands like a good thing abandoned by everybody else, a definite degree of maturity of economic and political relations. Here we have the essential difference between coup d'état, along Blanqui's conception, which are accomplished by an active minority and burst out like pistol shots, always inopportunely, and the conquest of political power by a great conscious popular mass, which can only be the product of the decomposition of bourgeois society and therefore bears in itself the economic and political legitimization of its opportune appearance. If, therefore, considered from the angle of political effect, the conquest of political power by the working class cannot materialize itself too early, then from the angle of conservation of power, the premature revolution, the thought of which keeps Bernstein awake, menaces us like a sword of Damocles. Against that, neither prayers nor supplication, neither scares nor any amount of anguish, are of any avail, and this for two very simple reasons. In the first place, it is impossible to imagine that a transformation as formidable as the passage from capitalist society to socialist society can be realised in one happy act. To consider that as possible is again to lend colour to conceptions that are clearly Blanquist. The socialist transformation supposes a long and stubborn struggle, in the course of which it is quite probable the proletariat will be repulsed more than once, so that for the first time, from the viewpoint of the final outcome of the struggle, it will have necessarily come to power too early. In the second place, it will be impossible to avoid the premature conquest of state power by the proletariat, precisely because these premature attacks of the proletariat constitute a factor, and indeed a very important factor, creating the political conditions of the final victory. In the course of the political crisis accompanying its seizure of power, in the course of the long and stubborn struggles, the proletariat will acquire the degree of political maturity permitting it to obtain in time a definitive victory of the revolution. Thus these premature attacks of the proletariat against the state power are in themselves important historic factors, helping to provoke and determine the point of the definite victory. Considered from this viewpoint, the idea of a premature conquest of political power by the labouring class appears to be a polemic absurdity derived from a mechanical conception of the development of society, and positing for the victory of the class struggle a point fixed outside and independent of the class struggle. Since the proletariat is not in the position to seize power in any other way than prematurely, since the proletariat is absolutely obliged to seize power once or several times too early before it can maintain itself in power for good, the objection